and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
Today's show is all about the Iditarod National Historic Trail. This isn't your average Iditarod dog mushing show, though. This is also a celebration. 2018 marks the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System, which includes the Iditarod Trail. The Iditarod Trail is the only winter trail in the National Trails System and the only congressionally designated National Historic Trail in Alaska. This event was sponsored by the Bureau of Land Management and took place at the Campbell Creek Science Center on February 21st. We go now to Kevin Keeler, administrator of the National Historic Trail, for today's presentation.
You've probably heard of the Appalachian Trail, the Pony Express, the Lewis and Clark. The Iditarod National Historic Trail is one of these trails. But when I got involved, I was wondering, what is it that makes the Iditarod Trail so important? What is nationally significant about it? That's why this trail was designated, because supposedly it has national significance. And it turns out it actually does. What was most significant about it is that it was America's last great gold rush trail. If you look back at all the gold rushes we've had in America, they started someplace like in the 1840s in Georgia, of all places. The one we know all about is the 1849, the big rush to California and that sort of thing. And the Iditarod really represents the last big gold rush that occurred in America, and that's why it was designated. Today we have 30 national trails in our national trail system, 19 national historic trails and 11 national scenic trails. And we're going to talk about the Iditarod to begin with, because I figured you guys are Iditarod trail fans and maybe even fans of winter, since you live in Alaska, are crazy enough to overwinter in a place like this, and we need something to look forward to at the end of winter. But we'll also talk about the national trail system too as we get going here. Like I mentioned, the Iditarod was one of the first national historic trails, along with the Mormon Pioneer, the Oregon Trail, and the Lewis and Clark Trail. The Iditarod Trail is Alaska's only national trail. It's the only one that has national historic trail designation, so that makes it a pretty big deal, basically. It's also, like I mentioned, America's last great gold rush trail. And it's the only winter trail on the national trail system. If you look at other trails like the Pony Express, the Santa Fe, these are crossing the desert. These are basically summertime trails. And something special and that's different about ours is, this is one that I gave to it itself, it's the only national trail dedicated to man's best friend. We're all about dogs on the Iditarod National Historic Trail. If you look at other ones like the Pony Express Trail, like the Juan Bautista de Anza National Historic Trail, those are around livestock, oxen, horses. But we instead, because of the advantages of dog team travel in Alaska, are focused on the dogs themselves. So let's get into the story of the trail itself. And the story really goes back to the native people who lived up here. This is a hard place to live in the wintertime and summertime year-round. And there was basically four different groups, Inupiaq, Athabascan, and Aleutik, who lived along the area that was ultimately crossed by the trail itself. The Inupiaq people being up in the Norton Sound area, the Athabascan being in the river areas of the Yukon-Kuskokwim area, the big dividing line of the Alaska Range, although that was crossed frequently by Native people, both from the Nikolai area and from Upper Cook Inlet. Then there's more Athabascan people who lived in this area. And then finally the Aleutik, the coastal people who lived in the area of Prince William Sound and Kodiak and the Seward area. As I mentioned, life was challenging in these places. There were surprisingly low populations in these areas, like in the Upper Kuskokwim Basin. If you look at the historic reports, the number of people numbered in the thousands, if at all, totally in these areas. And this is because it was such a hard place to live due to the lack of resources, the long, harsh seasons. And it just doesn't sustain a lot of people. When I get into that country, I think of it as hungry country. You just don't see a lot of wildlife up there. I mean, South Central Alaska compared to that part of the world is like verdant tropical, subtropical rainforest by comparison. Just not a lot of life happening up there. But then again, when it's 25 below for a month on end, you can understand why. Dogs for the native people who lived up here were everyday part of their village lives. But only the people who had the most resources were able to keep more than just a dog or two. Most people had a dog or two, and they really didn't use sleds that much. There's kind of a common misconception that there was a lot of sleds used at the time, but in reality, people used them for pack animals, to help move their camp, to fend off other wild animals. But there really wasn't dog mushing occurring as we know it at that time. But nonetheless, the dogs were an important part of their lifestyle. In the late 1700s, the Russians began colonizing Alaska for its riches, primarily its furs, and they followed the river systems into the interior. They established about a 3,000-mile supply chain all the way back to Moscow and St. Petersburg, and you read some of the accounts of them. It would take 2 to 3 years to get back to Moscow. Talk about a long trail to get someplace. Pretty crazy. You can read about their first-person exploits in one of the journals written by Lieutenant Lavardi Zagoskin. This is available pretty much on the internet, and he was with the Russian-American Company between 1842 and 1844. And he was the first person who discovered the passageway between the Yukon River and the coast, which is also called the Kaltag Portage here. Kaltag is at the east end, and Uniklete's at the west end. And this was a pretty well-guarded trade secret among the local folks there. The Russians had an inkling that they were close to the coast, but the folks who were their guides wouldn't show it to them. They'd often take them up dead-end river valleys or drainages and that sort of thing, because they used it as an important trade path between the interior people who used and manufactured basically their equipment for surviving from interior resources and the folks who lived on the coast who used coastal resources. So basically you get a different type of furs between beaver and sealskin, and they have their advantages and disadvantages for doing different things at different times of the year. Anyway, Zagoskin persisted and was able to determine and find that passageway and became the first of a number of non-native people who began to use that passageway. The Russians also brought some of the first names that were previously the written names, gave names to places, many of them that haven't survived. Interesting that Nitka, being the given name for Kinnick or Aklutna, what we know as Kinnick or Aklutna today, and a number of other Russian names too. The native people have had very well-adapted and perfected technology with very strong weaving skills, woodworking skills that were used for things such as fish nets, and the rivers to catch fish in the wintertime, and were adapted into technology like the building of sleds. Things like building kayaks, which is a very, very old tradition, were adapted, and you can almost see the same sort of mimicry in terms of the design of the sleds for what you might see in a kayak. But it took the Russians coming over here and introducing some of the new technologies to basically advance the technology of dog sledding and introduce it. They introduced the use of teams more, and because they were able to actually capture enough resources, you might say, or corner or garner resources to mush dogs, they were able to use dog teams to move their supplies out. They introduced things like the concept of a lead dog and also the single line for a dog team itself. In 1867, the United States bought Alaska from Russia, and one of the best deals ever, I think. And then it kind of lay fallow for a number of years. America didn't know what to do with this far-off territory, and we really didn't even have probably that good of a map as this one depicted right here. Like the Russians, Americans didn't explore much of the interior except using the river systems. It largely was an unknown land with large expanses that were still blank on the map. Then finally in 1897, gold was discovered in the Klondike, and that turned all the eyes in the country to the Yukon. And that's probably why they installed the RCMP at the top of the White Pass, because they didn't want America taking over the Yukon territory. I think that was an interest at the time. But there was lots of interest, and people began stampeding to the Klondike and realizing that maybe this wasn't such a folly for Secretary of State Seward to have bought the lands in Alaska. People brought the technology of gold mining north and moved quickly into the Klondike region. There was a number of other smaller gold rushes that were going on at the same time too. And basically what occurred was that settlement by Americans kind of came from both the southeast and the northwest, and both were kind of determined by their means of transportation, steamboats from the Pacific Island or Pacific Ocean from Seattle. So we'll be talking about some of these different gold rushes here, just a depiction of them as they occurred. In the mid-1890s, we had some of the first paying prospects in this neck of the woods here in the Hatcher Pass area, the Upper Susitna, and the newest stations for Americans were established at Kinnick and Susitna Station, which is now an abandoned town site on the lower Susitna River. Kinnick was established. Kinnick became the garden spot of South Central Alaska. Anchorage didn't exist at this time, and it became an important waypoint. It had a fairly deep water anchorage for it, and became the head of the trails for the interior up to Hatcher Pass, and ultimately into the Iditarod gold fields, and also the Petersville area and whatnot. So. In 1896, a fellow who called himself a colonel, but he necessarily wasn't a colonel, he staked some claims on Upper Crow Creek, which was at that time called Clacharo, and later named Glacier Creek, and now that community is known for him as Girdwood. This is the first map of the Girdwood area that I've been able to find, which is pretty darn neat, and it shows his claims on the upper part of the river. In 1898, as I mentioned, that a lot of this area was very unexplored. The U.S. Army was sending expeditions up here to reconnoiter the landscape, to put lines on the map, to determine where rivers flowed and what connections could be made. This is a map done by the 1898 expedition. And Colonel, or not Colonel, but Walter Mendenhall, who is a geologist for the U.S. Army expedition, he described, and they crossed over the Eagle River drainage at that time and described it as a miniature Yosemite. He also described it as having mosquitoes so countless in numbers and so patient and vicious in attack. So we know that. 1899, gold was discovered in Nome, the golden sands of Nome, and people went nuts in Nome, went nuts for Nome. No longer did they have to carry 1,000 pounds on their back up over the White Pass. They could basically hop on a steamboat in Seattle and just take the steamboat right up to Nome. And that brought a number of never-do-wells up there in that area. And also at the same time, too, because many of the gold claims had been staked and the work had been done in the gold fields around Dawson and the Klondike, people stampeded west down the Yukon River, crossed over the Caltag Portage that I'd mentioned there, and made their way to Nome. I looked up today this great description by Alfred Brooks, and he used to be the head of the U.S. Geologic Society, and the Brooks Range is named after him. And he wrote a book about his description of riding downriver from Eagle. And this is his quote. "I boarded the first downriver boat with difficulty, for it was already crowded with passengers from Dawson. It had received the culls from the Klondike, who would not venture until the future of the new El Dorado was assured. The majority of my fellow passengers were those who formed the parasites in a new gold camp. Gamblers, thieves, thugs, and women of the lower world crowded the steamer to its capacity." This is the best line. "My sleep under a table in the dining room was broken by the noise of a gambling game going on over my head." The stories of going on these steamboats, it's not like we experience today when we're traveling on commercial transportation. Basically, when you got on these steamboats, hopefully you didn't have a drunken captain. Hopefully you had adequate supplies of fuel because you might have to go ashore and help cut the fuel. Hopefully there's enough food on the boat to get you where you were going because you might have to go ashore and actually hunt for your next meal. Some of these boats basically got frozen in at times. It's just a wealth of stories in terms of riding these boats up and down the Yukon River and from Seattle up in this neck of the woods.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. You've been hearing an in-depth history of the Iditarod National Historic Trail. We'll go back to Kevin Keeler, an administrator for the Bureau of Land Management, as he explains to us the events and eventual gold rush that made the trail what it is today.
So gold was booming in Nome, and Nome became the first one of the first big metropolises in in Alaska. Things haven't really changed, I think, much from the reality TV shows that we see these days. And all the goods for Nome came in from the sea, basically. They were brought in by ship, and back in those days, winters were colder, and we walked 6 miles to school after milking cows. A lot of times, the mail or the goods didn't arrive until like June or July. And literally, the winters were colder. The records that have been established, I've looked at some for Anchorage, 1915, 1917, 1920. They would have long stretches of sub-20 below weather here that I have not seen in a number of years myself. And I think we just don't have that weather any longer. So Nome was isolated for basically 6 months of the year. People couldn't get in or out of Nome except if they went overland by dog team in the winter time. And so people had a lot of time on their hands. Nome had a lot of wealth because there was a lot of gold coming out of Nome. So there was a lot of money floating around and a lot of resources. One of Alaska's biggest communities at that time. I think the second largest after Juneau. And at this time, Fairbanks had not been established either. So with a lot of time on their hands, what are they going to do? Well, we've got these dogs. They've been pulling sleds around. Why don't we race these dogs? So this is really where dog racing became established. 100 years ago, 110 years ago in Nome, when people had these dog teams, it was a common way to get around. And they established a number of shorter distance races that started to get out into longer distance races. The All-Alaska Sweepstakes was ultimately the longest race. It was a 400-mile round trip. A lot of the dog breeding that we see today, at least in the earlier parts of dog mushing that happened in Alaska, occurred up there. For instance, somebody brought over a team of Siberian Huskies one of the first years, and everybody laughed at him until he just about won the race. And after that time, everybody got into Siberian Huskies and started racing Huskies. So there's a lot of personalities established then, a lot of gold dust traded back and forth, a lot of betting that went on for these dog teams. And there was also the establishment of a number of animal care rules. They basically lifted the whole animal care rule book from the horse racing that was going on in the lower 48 to the Kentucky Derby. There was all kinds of pageantry associated with the racing. The different teams would have different colors. There'd be flagging. There'd be, you know, names for the teams, this sort of thing. So it was a pretty big deal in Nome. As I mentioned, there's a fair amount of betting going on there, a purse of $4,000. And what's really interesting, if any of you guys, I imagine some of you guys follow the Iditarod sled dog race, and maybe even you look at some of those split times and the mushers running between checkpoints and stuff like that. I mean, it really hasn't changed. You got the racers, and here you got the checkpoints, and here's their in times and out times. I mean, we're basically doing the same sort of thing we were doing 100 years ago. We're just doing it now with the internet and sat phones and more increasingly with drones this year. So, four-legged celebrities were established then. Baldy of Nome, this is a book that you can still find out there. And Leonard Sepala, who became the most winningest musher of his day and later became famous for his role in the Serum Run. And he built his kennel and sled dog racing teams winning four of these All-Alaska sweepstakes, which were about 400 miles long, ran 200 miles up to the village of Candle and then back again. And there's a telegraph line that went the whole way, so they're able to keep these times and the split times on all these dog teams. It was also a very important occurrence when the mail came to town in those days. Newspapers were very valuable, although there was a wireless station in the town. And this was kind of fun to see because there's a term that we use here still today. Outside mail arrived at Nome Post Office. So they were calling the lower 48 the outside back in those days too, which is pretty fun. So back down our way. I hadn't mentioned before, but Seward became established in the early 1900s as a ice-free port that could get people up into South Central Alaska for the different mining and resource development desires that people had, and a railroad was established there. The railroad was first started by one company, and they ran up out to about Bear Lake, not very far out of town. They went bankrupt, and then they got bought out by another railroad, and that railroad built up the railroad to Kern Creek, which is basically just the other side of Girdwood, if you're familiar with Turnagain Arm down that way. And then they went bankrupt, and so the railroad was fallow for a number of years down there. Seward established itself as a regional hub. Contract mail started between Seward and Susitna Station over the Crow Pass Trail that we know is back in Chugach State Park today. And in 1908, the Indian Pass Ship Creek route opened up. And so there was competition between these two routes, partly because there was a bigger threat for avalanches and snowslides in the Crow Pass Trail than there was in the Indian Pass Trail. But as you may or may not know, Anchorage didn't exist at this time, so people were just going up and over Indian Pass and then heading up around Knik Arm to deliver their mail. So in 1908, the Alaska Road Commission, which was charged with developing trails and roads in Alaska, sent out an expedition to look at the feasibility of establishing a trail between Seward and Nome. Previously, most overland goods were coming from Seward and then up toward where Bear Flanks was ultimately going to be located and then down to Seward. So that was about a 1,500-mile journey. And they thought that, well, if we went in here at Seward, we could maybe knock off 500 miles of this journey here have a shorter route for all concerned. And so he went out in 1908 and did this expedition. You can still read the account today. One of our partners has published, republished the account of Colonel Goodwin, and the original is typed in a very government-looking document about his trail report. They ran a cyclometer down the trail to measure the distances on the trail and came up with some pretty accurate distances. Interestingly, this route, pretty much the most difficult part of the trail was up and over Crow Pass, what Goodwin found. When they basically got down to the railroad, they called that the end of steel. And so packing was fairly easy in those days, but it wasn't all that easy because they actually ran their dog teams down the railroad tracks and the railroad right away. And if you've ever taken the train to Seward, you've maybe gone through some of those tunnels there and over those trestles. They used to run their dog teams through those tunnels and over those trestles. Just, it's pretty amazing to me. So Goodwin also concluded, too, that while it's possible to do this route, we really don't have the need for it yet. There's really not a big population in this part of the state. It's still pretty empty here, the territory, I'm sorry. And unless something happens there to draw our attention into that area and the need, there's really no reason to build this trail. Well, something happened in 1908. On Christmas Day, gold was discovered in a place called Discovery Creek of such an original name, which ultimately became the center of the Iditarod gold fields. It took about a year and a half for the news to get out, basically because this is about 1,000 miles from nowhere, literally. So it was a long way to get there. It took like about a half a year for the guys to get out. Word finally got to Fairbanks. Fairbanks had been established then, but they got the word in the fall, and nobody was able to make it to Iditarod. They weren't able to get enough equipment together, and basically everybody got frozen in. As I mentioned, it was a long journey up there, and really until they marshaled the steamboats, the technology of the day to get up there, it was pretty hard for people to get in. But once people did get in, they came, and they came quickly. Basically, in June of 1910, about 1,000 tons of building material was landed at present-day Iditarod. Anyway, lots of freight was moved quickly into the country up there, as it was determined that there was a fair amount of gold, paying gold in that country. The actual gold fields themselves are over the hills about 7 miles away in a place called Flat. And Iditarod itself was on an oxbow. So here's Iditarod. And Iditarod was chosen because it's the head of navigation. It's as far as you could get a steamboat in those days. And so it's as far as you could get your building materials. And the actual gold fields are over this hill here about 7 miles. And this is a community of Flat that was established over there. So these two places kind of became twin cities back in those days. Iditarod and Flat were really different in that Flat had some gravel to work with. Iditarod was built out on the tundra, and there are actually some stories of horses even getting lost in the muck in spring breakup and literally drowning in the muck. You can see they just took whatever was left of building materials and threw them down. The streets were really wide here to prevent fires. And unlike our conception of Wild West towns, by this time, these people had been moving from town to town to town, settling these towns. And they knew what it took to have these towns survive. And they knew it took things like fire prevention, wide streets, so you wouldn't burn down both sides of the street when you inevitably had a fire. And you look at the stuff that's out there, too. It is so ridiculously flammable. They used to use these wall coverings that were like this muslin cloth and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, my God. And they're heating with these open gas lanterns and heating with wood. And so inevitably, these places burnt down. And, of course, gold was happening. It was really being mined out of the Flat area. But because of its proximity to the place where it can be transshipped, on the rivers, Iditarod was really established as a commercial center. So there's all these people up in this country, and they want some service. They want their mail. They want to be connected to the rest of the country. So these commercial clubs, not unlike our Chamber of Commerce is today, they lobbied for the establishment of trails, of overland routes for people to get back and forth across the countryside along with their goods. And Colonel Goodwin again, and I think he was actually truly a colonel. He was tabbed to oversee the construction of a new route that would go through Crow Pass and then ultimately dogleg down to the Iditarod gold fields and connect Iditarod and Nome, basically, and all those trails. And basically did that in about a winter. And every year there'd be a pulse of traffic going up the trail in the fall with other people coming out. In the fall also, and there was regular service that you could hire a dog team, or you could hire basically travel as a passenger if you wanted to. And a lot of people actually walked the trails too, because it was pretty expensive at that time to hire a dog team and travel by dog team. A series of roadhouses and lodges, basically roadhouses, sprung up to provide sustenance and shelter for people. People really didn't camp out in those days. We didn't have the miniature lightweight backpacking gear we have. And staying in a cabin was almost like camping in those days. The cabins were pretty rough. The U.S. government actually encouraged these roadhouses to be established. So there were roadhouses established pretty much at 20-mile intervals. And that's what people pretty much traveled in a day, either by dog team or by sled. And this is because back in those days, the dog teams were big, burly dogs that were pulling maybe 1,000 pounds of freight, pulling the mail, pulling a load of gold. They were regularly taking gold loads out of Iditarod down to Seward and then putting it on the boat to Seattle. So today, the remnants of these roadhouses exist. There's very few of them left out there. Mostly are just tumbled in. Log-walled structures. A lot of times they had sod roofs, so they really didn't survive the years. And there's very few of them left out there these days. People weren't only traveling on foot. amazingly, people were traveling by bicycle back in those days. That was one of the newest pieces of technology, and there's some great accounts of people traveling up and down the Yukon River, traveling over the Iditarod Trail, traveling up the Richardson Trail to Fairbanks on what they called in this day the wheel. And so we might laugh at people who are out on fat bikes nowadays who are riding, but there really is a history of this that occurred 100 years ago, which is pretty darn neat, I think. So anyway, the towns of Iditarod and Flat prospered. They had telephone systems. They had wireless to communicate to the outside world. They had basketball teams in each of the towns. They would play each other in the wintertime, travel back and forth. But the writing was on the wall for these areas, and that was because there was changes in the mining technology. Many of the claims were consolidated by the Guggenheim Group. They brought in large dredges that had been perfected in other places, among them the lower 48, and rebuilt these dredges. And they would bring these dredges in from a place like Fairbanks, that they maybe got it up there by steamship. They would take the whole thing apart. These things weigh like, 500 tons or something like that. Take the whole thing apart and then ship it overland by dog team, piece by piece by piece, and then take them to places like Iditarod and rebuild the things again. Amazing. Anyway, I mentioned days were numbered to finish that part of the story. Because they weren't mining with one miner, one pick, one shovel, it basically a large machine was able to replace a lot of the people. There was a need for less miners up there. And so miners started to drift away. The population started to shrink of those areas. And then in 1915, the magic town of Anchorage was created. And this is when Seward's death knell occurred. They were never able to achieve their dream of being the San Francisco of the North when Anchorage was picked to be the head of the Alaska Railroad. And with that, the new government railroad coming, people recognized that there were steady jobs to be had, and so a lot of people left Iditarod. People that we maybe recognize some of their names here today, for instance, Lusac, the Lusac Library, he used to be the druggist in Iditarod. Bagoy's Flowers, the Bagoy's in Iditarod had the only cow in Iditarod, which was fairly important at the time. And these people ultimately migrated to Anchorage, and Anchorage became the hub of Alaska at that time with the building of the railroad, which took a long time because it's a heck of a hard place to build a railroad, as we know. Specialized accommodations were built in Anchorage. Some of the hotels actually even had dog barns here. The Alaska Railroad was building special stock cars to carry dog teams on after they got the railroad going down to Seward. And they were advertising in the engineering bulletin, because it was pretty much a company town in those days, for people to stay off the tracks in those days too. The mushers had been using the tracks. Just like today, people are getting on the tracks, and they're telling them to get off the tracks and use our train service instead.
This is KSKA Anchorage. You are listening to Addressing Alaskans. Today, we are hearing from Kevin Keeler, an administrator for the Iditarod National Historic Trail for the Bureau of Land Management. He has been sharing details of the final Alaskan gold rush that brought people up here from the lower 48 states and ultimately created the Iditarod Trail as we know it today. We now go back to the presentation as we move into the era of the Serum Run that made the trail famous nationwide.
Pretty much the end of the era of dog mushing was around the 1925 Serum Run. A lot of people think the Iditarod Sled Dog Race is formed to commemorate the 1925 Serum Run, but it really wasn't. It was formed to commemorate the culture of dog mushing, running out to the Iditarod gold fields, and the use of the trail itself. But so in 1925, if you're not familiar with the story, there's a diphtheria outbreak in Nome, and the only antitoxin that was available was in Anchorage at the time, so it was shipped by railroad to Nenana, and then from there it was relayed by a team of a series of dog teams down the Nenana River and then onto the Iditarod Trail at Caltag and across Norton Sound to Nome in 5.5 days, which is a pretty darn fast run even in these times. and temperatures are really cold. There's stories of people's hands being frozen to their sleds, and these people were realizing that there was the town of Nome was really at stake here. So all eyes of the country turned to this. And of course, the hero of that serum run was Togo, in my estimation. Balto finished. He got all the glory, but it was really Togo who did all the work. Togo was the lead dog for Sepala on many of his All-Alaska sweepstakes. Basically, let's go back here. So Balto basically ran the trail from about here to Nome, about 30 miles or so. Togo ran the trail from Nome all the way to here, all the way down to here, and then met somebody who was coming across the ice with the serum. They actually went, they were trying to go right across here, which is a really long shot. And they met him here in the midst of a blizzard, then turned around and went back and dropped the serum off to Balto to take in for the last 20 miles. So really, in my estimation, it was Togo who was the hero. And Leonard Sepala, who was driving him, really didn't get his due. It led to a lot of bad blood between those because Balto was kind of a second-string dog compared to Togo. And if you really want to hear some opinions, ask somebody that did around Mushers about what they think about Balto and Togo. So anyway, that's the rest of the story on that one. Anyway, all eyes of the world was on this. The media that we know today had cranked up pretty well because there were wireless stations that transmitted the news cross-country and across the world, and newspapers that picked it up, and people around the world were following this serum run as it occurred. But really, what brought on the death knell to a large degree for mail service and whatnot was the introduction of the aircraft. Ultimately, they started with regular freight service, and there was regular aircraft service between Flat and Fairbanks. And so the mail was taken over by this increasingly perfected technology that we use today to get around on the trail. Now we have an Iditarod Air Force even. But during that time, the need for shelter cabins continued. And people were still traveling back and forth between the communities. And so more shelter cabins were built out there on the trail. And as I mentioned, they're pretty rough affairs, but they'd have a wood stove in them and some bunks and a place to get out of the weather. Iditarod really became depopulated, though, in the 1920s. Basically, the river shifted course. Aircraft now could just, and freight would just bypass Iditarod. And pretty much only a few more people lived in Iditarod in the 1920s. And so when the river bypassed the town with no more steamboat service, it really became an empty hulk of itself. Anyway, so come race time, there'll be 80-100 bales of hay in here and a lot of people and a lot of action occurring. What's interesting to me is when we look at those pictures of the Iditarod and what was going on, this was what was going on in America in the big cities. America was big cities, even though it was still a pretty rural country in a lot of ways. We had some really big cities. I mean, the cities have not changed much except for maybe the introduction of the automobile. Pretty big, bruising places, noisy, smelly, stinky, not much room for nature, greenery, that sort of thing, and people felt something was missing. When I was looking at developing this talk, I was going to do something along the lines of the America's 50 years of America's favorite trails. But when I dug into these stories, I found out that people have been interested and out on trails and in nature for a long time. And because of this industrialization that occurred at the turn of the 20th century, we had clubs forming like the Appalachian Mountain Club. The Green Mountain Club established the first long-distance hiking trail in the early 1900s on the Green Mountains in Vermont. The Sierra Club was established as a hiking club originally for people to get out and enjoy these places. This is the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. Congress noticed that people had this craving, and they established things such as the Antiquities Act in 1908, which ultimately protected places like the Grand Canyon. The United States Forest Service was established in 1905, the National Park Service in 1916. Conservation was burgeoning 100 years ago, and people realized that nature was important in their lives and that it's something to be appreciated and conserved. And interestingly, too, as the continent was filling up and Manifest Destiny, as we knew it, the continent was basically crossed with telegraph lines and railroads from coast to coast. Some of the people who were out there on these expeditions or their descendants realized that this heritage may be going away. So, for instance, in the early 1900s, the Daughters of the American Revolution established memorials for the Santa Fe Trail across the southwest of the United States. And another fellow by the name of Ezra Meeker was a longtime advocate for the establishment of the Old Oregon Trail. He marked the Old Oregon Trail, and this guy really reminds me, he's kind of cut of the same cloth as Joe Reddington Sr. He traveled in ox cart on the Oregon Trail to Wall Street, New York City, stopping all the way across the country and raising public appreciation and interest in some commemoration for the Oregon Trail. The story was when he got to New York City, the acting mayor said it would be okay if he came and brought livestock into the town, but the police didn't get the message, and so he got busted for 4 or 5 days. But ultimately he met with the president, and this is Teddy Roosevelt, and made his case for the establishment, for some federal recognition and funding for this old historic trail. Then in the 1920s, the Appalachian Trails Conference was formed to promote the idea of a trail down the spine of the Appalachian Mountains to basically give people a refuge from the teeming cities of the East Coast. It was originally proposed by Benton McKay, who's not pictured here, to join all the cities of the West or the East with this long-distance crestline trail system here, and to create basically a one large greenway system. In the 1930s, a school teacher in Bellingham came up with the idea and enlisted an oil man by the name of Clayton Clark, and he organized 40 teams of YMCA youth to hike basically between Canada and Mexico on what's today the Pacific Crest Trail. So these people are out there doing this stuff years ago, which is really interesting to me to find out, to learn about it. Then in 1945, the federal government introduced their first trail bill to attach to a federal highway bill, but it didn't pass at that time. In the 1950s, an Outdoor Recreation Review Council was established. They created a report called Outdoor Recreation in America. In 1964, Senator Gaylord Nelson introduced a bill to recognize the Appalachian Trail, to acquire land from willing sellers, to use some funds from the Land and Water Conservation Fund, but it did not at that time pass Congress. But two people who were really instrumental were both the Johnsons. First Lady, Lady Bird Johnson, was very instrumental and played a huge role in the establishment of the National Trail System, and President Johnson. In 1965, he gave a beautification speech that really articulated his administration's view on the environment. He said, "The forgotten outdoorsmen of today are those who like to walk, hike, ride horseback, or bicycle. For them, we must have trails as well as highways. I'm requesting, therefore, that the Secretary of Interior work with his colleagues and with state and local leaders and recommend to me a cooperative program to encourage national system of trails, building up more than 100,000 miles of trails in our national forest and park. In the backcountry, we need to copy the great Appalachian Trail in all parts of America and make use of the rights of ways and other public paths." So in 1967, nothing had happened yet, and he had a special message to Congress about protecting our national heritage, and he again urged that a nationwide system of trails be established, and that they be modeled on the Appalachian Trail and include other trails themselves. And in basically a year's time, between 1967 and 1968, Congress wrangled over it and signed the bill on October 2nd, 1968, that established the National Trail System, which is one of the things we're celebrating tonight. We've got stickers back there for celebrating the 50th anniversary of the National Trail System, and also at the same time, he signed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, So both of these important acts that have ultimately protected and conserved thousands of miles of trails and rivers in our country were established. And so that's what we're celebrating, commemorating here tonight. So the original act in 68 called for these new national scenic trails and national recreation trails, which were local trails to be locally designated. Some of the national recreation trails that we have close to town here, there's one that goes around the Campbell Airstrip here. It's called the Campbell Airstrip National Recreation Trail. The Tony Knowles Coastal Trail is a national recreation trail. The Resurrection Trail down on the Kenai Peninsula in Chugach National Forest is also a national recreation trail. This basically elevates these trails as being some of the better trails in the country, although not the top-tier trails like National Historic and Scenic Trails. But at this time, National Historic Trails hadn't been created. But in government fashion, this act, the National Trail System Act, called for the study of 14 more routes, including the Iditarod Trail. Well, this was an interesting coincidence because at that very same time in Alaska, there was these upstarts by the name of Joe Reddington Sr. and a bunch of other folks who were putting together a 1,000-mile race on this old gold mining trail, basically between Anchorage and Nome.
You are tuned in to Addressing Alaskans here on Alaska Public Media. On today's program, we are learning about the beginnings of the Iditarod Historic National Trail from a trail expert. Kevin Keeler, administrator for the trail, is explaining the races and events that brought us to the last great race that we have today.
These were long-term affairs. Back in those days, it was more of a camping trip than a race. The first race got bogged down in the vicinity of Ruby, and I think they were on the verge of shooting some moose because they had ran out of food and the food shipments hadn't gotten through. Joe Reddington mortgaged his house, et cetera, et cetera. There's just all these amazing stories about the first races that happened out there. But these guys also were very instrumental in pushing for the establishment of this trail as a National Historic Trail. One of the goals of the organization was to protect the old Iditarod Trail for public use. And it's really no surprise, if you look at the two emblems for the two different trails, you'll see that the dogs are basically the same. These two things came about at the same time. They really kind of fed off each other. This design was by a fellow by the name of Bill Devine, who's since passed away, like many of our early Iditarod pioneers. And it was the same dog, basically. That report that Congress had required recommended the establishment of the Iditarod Trail as a new class of trail, these National Historic Trails. So in 1978, along with the Mormon Pioneer, Oregon, and Lewis and Clark Trails, this class of trails was established. And so today we've got 19 National Historic Trails and 11 National Scenic Trails all around the country. And with that, over 2,000 miles of national trail were designated here in Alaska. But because Alaska is managed and owned by all these different landowners, it took a plan of how to provide for this trail. And this trail is really different than a lot of the National Historic Trails in the Lower 48. The concept in the Lower 48 is that, well, there's a wagon rut over there, and there's a Pony Express station over there, but you can't go from point to point. Well, us being Alaskans, we're different. We go point to point every year. We cross the whole thing pretty much. And it's still an important piece of transportation for people to do subsistence in the villages, for recreation. So our trail's a bit different up here. So an interagency plan was done that was ultimately adopted between the Bureau of Land Management, the State of Alaska, other federal agencies in 1986. That was a concept plan. It identified the basic things that needed to happen on the trail. And that has laid out the groundwork for us. My job is basically to implement this thing here or facilitate implementation of this thing. So the National Trails Act and this, it tells us to go forth and partner, basically. This isn't kind of a typical stovepipe government delivery. We just throw some money at the project and try to get something done. We're doing our work in partnership with different groups. And really, our work wouldn't be accomplished unless we were able to do things in partnership. Here's a couple of our guys out at the Roan Cabin last year for the Iron Dog Sled Dog Race, which just finished up this weekend. Our partner group, we have a statewide partner group, the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance. They provided funding to hire a Student Conservation Association crew last year, which work in Chugach State Park on our own miniature Yosemite, the Crow Pass Trail here, shown here. So there are a lot of opportunities for folks to give back, and I'd encourage you to look into this group that we're working with this year. You're going to hear more about this in the coming year. We're shining the light and putting a lot of love on the Crow Pass Trail. That trail is really getting loved to death, and we're going to have a number of different outreach efforts to educate people about how to use the trail without hurting it and to make some improvements for the next 50 years on that trail. So Alaska Trail Stewards is a statewide nonprofit that we work with, and they're organizing different volunteer events in the South Central area. So anyway, happy 50th to the National Trail System, and we've got some social media events going on, hashtag Find Your Trail, and some of our partners, Iditarod100.org and BLM. We have a website, blm.gov/Iditarod. And we've got some stuff on there, some good maps and whatnot. And I also encourage you to take a look at some of our partners' websites, the events that are going on. The Iron Dog's going on right now. The Iditarod Sports going on right now. The Iditarod Invitational starts next weekend. So there's people out on the trail now on bikes, on foot, on snowmobiles. And in a couple, in next weekend, they're going to be out there with dog teams. So anyway, well, thanks for coming out tonight.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from Kevin Keeler, an administrator for the Iditarod Historic National Trail for the Bureau of Land Management. He brought us a full history of the trail at a fireside chat at the Campbell Creek Science Center. If you missed a portion of the show, you can always go back and listen to it again by visiting the Addressing Alaskans page at alaskapublic.org or subscribe to the podcast on your favorite device. I'm your host and producer for Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.